Welcome, listeners, to the first episode of Undisclosed, the State v. Jamara Huggins. Our sponsors for this episode include our most delicious sponsor, Blue Apron, our most secure sponsor, Simply Safe, and new sponsor, Tripping.com. Make sure you listen in for those spots later in the episode and support our sponsors because they support us. Until then, enjoy the program.
This episode of Undisclosed contains language that might be objectionable to some listeners.
A man languishes in a prison cell in South Carolina due to a law passed to protect people just like him. If his trial had taken place before 1982, or in almost any other state, he would be a free man. In 1982, though, the Supreme Court of South Carolina made a change to an evidentiary principle that had been applied in the Palmetto State for centuries. It was that change that led to a man by the name of Jamara Huggins from Conway, South Carolina, being convicted in 2013 of three felonies and sentenced to a total of 40 years incarceration. It was a conviction that seemingly shocked everyone in the courtroom. Huggins, his family, both attorneys, even the judge. Arguably, there was no evidence to support this conviction, and in fact, Huggins could have taken a plea deal that would have led to no time in prison. Instead, Huggins sits in a prison cell in South Carolina and waits. So does his family. Here's Jamar's sister, Denedra, describing the effect of what the family believes to be a wrongful conviction.
It has been devastating. Like I said, our family is very close. My mom has five kids. Jamar is the only boy, and he's kind of like the one that everybody kind of goes to. He's the male figure of the family, and to not have him has just really put a black cloud over the family.
So why did South Carolina change the law with centuries of wisdom and experience behind it? The Supreme Court of South Carolina made this change in large part because it believed that the existing evidence rule required judges to give unrealistic and confusing instructions to the jury about how to apply it. In announcing this change to the law, South Carolina's highest court proclaimed, quote, "We believe the adoption of this rule will more effectively aid in the discovery of truth and more adequately ensure the freedom of the innocent and the conviction of the guilty." Now, I'll get to the specifics of this law in a future episode, but there's another law that has importance here, and that's the law of unintended consequences. Although the concept of unintended consequences dates back to at least John Locke, it was sociologist Robert Merton who popularized the law of unintended consequences in his 1936 paper, The Unanticipated Consequences of Purposive Social Action. According to Merton, unintended consequences can result from five possible causes, including ignorance, analytical errors, and self-defeating prophecies. Meanwhile, the unintended consequences themselves can take three forms. First, they can be unexpected benefits, like the decline in the use of lead paint and, more importantly, leaded gasoline, leading to a precipitous drop in crime in several countries. Second, they can be unexpected drawbacks, like prohibition leading to a consolidation in power and organized crime over the illegal alcohol industry, or the war on drugs leading to a similar consolidation of power in drug cartels. And finally, they can be perverse results, what are often referred to as the Streisand effect, based upon Barbara Streisand's lawsuit against a website posting images of her Malibu home, only calling more attention to those photos. In the prosecution of Jamara Huggins, it seems like the law of unintended consequences led to a perverse result. When South Carolina changed its evidence rule back in 1982, it did so to avoid confusing jurors and to ensure the freedom of the innocent. But under the rule of evidence at the time, Jamara Huggins' case never would have made it to a jury. Instead, it would have been dismissed. It was only as a result of the change, a change that makes South Carolina like merely a handful of other jurisdictions in the country, that the jury could even return a guilty verdict. And it's a verdict that could lead to an innocent man being locked up for at least a decade and a half. Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law. I moved to South Carolina in the summer of 2012, about half a year before a home invasion in the small town of Conway, South Carolina in Horry County on December 20th. According to the prosecution, Jamara Huggins was the ringleader of that crime. Jamara's sister Denedra, however, feels that the Horry County Police Department's investigation into her brother's case fell short of the mark.
Conway is a very good community, it's a good town, but I don't think as far as the law enforcement go, that they have the proper training that they should have, because in just looking at it, they didn't investigate nothing. Like, when they came to pick my brother up, if there's a robbery and all these things that you're telling us, why not search the house? Why are you not looking for a gun? Why did you not search his car? Like, nothing was done properly. Y'all just went off of a nickname, and you ended up with my brother. That, to me, was unacceptable. When you are handling somebody's life and everybody who is around them is affected by this, I feel like you should give 110% into the investigation.
Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Blue Apron has established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the U.S. And here's the big deal for those of you who, like me, are pescatarians or simply love fish. Their seafood is sourced sustainably under standards developed in partnership with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch. And over the next month, you can get great fish dishes from Blue Apron, such as those with barramundi, cod, and catfish. So here's the deal. For less than $10 per person per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. You can choose from a variety of new recipes each week, and you can customize your recipes each week based upon your preferences. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients, and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Plus, Blue Apron's freshness guarantee promises that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook, or they'll make it right. So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/undisclosed. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/undisclosed. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Located about 20 miles northwest of popular tourist destination Myrtle Beach, Conway was founded in 1732, making it one of South Carolina's oldest towns, with a population of around 21,000. The Waccamaw River winds beside Conway's downtown, which has many of its buildings listed in the National Historic Register. Isaac Bailey, a reporter who has written about the Huggins case, describes Conway as an idyllic southern town where they have worked hard to maintain the old school look. Conway is the birthplace of Wheel of Fortune host Vanna White, as well as William Gibson, who coined the phrase cyberspace. The city is racially diverse, about 56% Caucasian and 42% African American. The median age in Conway is just over 30, but there's a short, dead-end road in western Conway named Memory Lane, where the residents are considerably older. 33-year-old Angela Eckler and her fiancé Adrian Moore rented a house at the end of Memory Lane. They were the youngest couple on the street. Eckler ran a babysitting business, and most days, Eckler would leave her front door not only unlocked, but also open, signifying the safety she felt. Other people who have lived in Conway feel the same way. I talked with a former resident of Conway, who lived there for many years before moving to Columbia, the state capital.
As far as my experience goes, it's pretty minimal crime. You don't hear about a whole lot, especially now that I live in Columbia. In comparison to Columbia, it's nothing similar. It's a small town. Outside of the downtown area, those rural areas, I think that there was more drug use and that sort of thing, which I think is pretty common in rural, especially in the rural South. So I remember hearing about that, but day to day, I think you would be safe not locking your doors.
Eckler is also a longtime Conway resident, and let's start by going back in time, all the way to the late 80s, early 90s. Back then, Eckler and Adrian Moore, the son of a preacher, were Conway classmates in elementary and middle school.
Him and I went to school together. I hadn't seen him in 20 years. We went to school together. He was the only African-American that was in our school. I never looked at him as a black man. His daddy's a preacher, very good family. He had, throughout the years, he had moved to Nebraska.
As is increasingly the case with couples around the world, Eckler and Moore reconnected over social media, specifically Facebook.
And that's where we had gotten, you know, just through Facebook, he had, you know, just seen that their kids' father and I weren't together anymore because we had lots of mutual friends that we went to school with. And throughout a whole year of talking and coercing back and forth before he ever came here. And then he's actually lived in South Carolina for a year and 2 months.
This Facebook courtship took place in 2010 and 2011 before Moore moved to Conway in the fall of 2011. Since moving to South Carolina, Moore had lived with Eckler and the two had been planning their wedding. Moore was simultaneously going to school and trying to find a job.
He was seekingly looking for a job, and I knew that he was looking for a job, but he was having a hard time finding a job because nobody would work around his school schedule.
Finally, on December 4th, 2012, about 2 weeks before the crime in this case, Moore found some work.
He had made it to this work ready place on Church Street, and that they had offered him to, you know, to work, but it'd only be a few hours. It was one of those places where you just work when they need you. It wasn't a, you know, that place that, that he was at was not a job per se. It was on a day-to-day basis. And I said, you know, he's like, you know, it'll help with Christmas. And, you know, I said, okay. So he worked and he said that he would be, you know, 10 o'clock or so, he'd be home. Well, he called me at 10, it was a little bit before 10, and he said, you know, that somebody had called out for the next shift.
As a result, Moore didn't return home Monday night, and he actually worked at the job for the next 2 days.
But anyway, he was gone Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday at this job that he had.
Okay.
And at the time, I didn't, you know, Adrian had given me no reason to not trust him at all.
He'd been How was he getting to this job?
Well, he had had my expedition.
Okay, so he's taken your call.
So he had taken the expedition.
But that was it. 3 days at this new job, followed by a return to his studies. The following Monday, December 11th, 2012, Moore was supposed to take an exam.
I knew he was supposed to take his exam at Coastal Carolina.
Coastal Carolina University is a national Sea Grant institution located in Conway. In 2016, the school's baseball team became the talk of the town and the country when it won the College World Series.
He got him, and it's all over! Coastal Carolina rules the roost. They win the championship!
The announcer's mention of ruling the roost is a reference to Coastal Carolina's mascot, the Chanticleer, a rooster character in Geoffrey Chaucer's The Canterbury Tales. In this tale, a fox gains the trust and confidence of Chanticleer, creating the opportunity for the fox to double-cross the rooster and commit his crime. Something similar happened in the relationship between Eckler and Moore. Moore told Eckler that he felt bad about not bringing home the bacon, a phrase that itself might have originated in The Canterbury Tales. As a result, Moore got Eckler to open a joint banking account and promised to take on the responsibility of making deposits into that account. But on the 11th, right before Moore was scheduled to take his exam, Eckler had gotten a phone call from her bank.
In the meantime, that's before noon is when I had actually got on the bank account and realized that we were in the hole.
Okay.
Because the bank had called and said that they wanted to make sure that the card hadn't been stolen.
Okay.
Because there was multiple uses being on his card. So they put a hold on his card, and I didn't know anything about it. And even after that, he was trying to get money.
Moore's withdrawals led to what mathematicians call a change of sign.
The negative balance now is $2,250-some. And
what was there supposed to be in there?
There should have been at least two, almost two, because we had to make the house payment for December.
According to Eckler, this behavior by Moore came out of left field.
There was nothing. Even the whole time that man lived here, I mean, he and even my soon-to-be in-laws.
No indicators that there was something.
They liked him.
Okay.
You know, he was active with my kids. He never let on that anything in the whole year that he lived here was anything to do with being in a mischief.
Okay.
So never did he drink any alcoholic beverages, nothing of that nature. We never went out. We never had any drinks. That's not what we did. For him to lead up to taking this money is what I'm trying to get at.
Okay.
There was no signs of anything.
Okay.
Upon learning the news about the bank account, Eckler immediately left Moore a message.
After he had got my voicemail, but never responded to my voicemail about why in the hell
are
we, yeah, you know, this, what the hell is this? Is when he sent me a text. I'll call you when I get out. Wish me luck, you know, about getting taken this test.
After Eckler tried to reach Moore for hours, he finally called her back.
Because I'd blown up his phone. I left by that time. I had, you know, was not being saying very nice things because he wasn't returning my messages. And he's like, I'm here on Church Street.
Upon hearing this news, Eckler's mother drove to Church Street to find Moore, and coming up empty, went to the Conway police station.
So she went there on Tuesday, and as she was there telling him, they're telling the police officers, like, about the money and about what, you know, he was on Church Street. There was a dispatch in. And as she was standing there, the dispatch come in that they had had a report of a man, a male, on Church Street that was needed, you know, was acting in bizarre behavior. And he asked my mother, you know, what did you say his name was? And she said his name's Adrian Moore. She said that that's when the police officer told her that there was a call and that he was acting, you know, it was bizarre, and that he was acting in bizarre behaviors, all they could tell her. And that he was yelling that he, you know, wanted to kill himself or whatever, and that he was going to be the EMT, had taken Adrian to the Conway Medical Center.
A few days later, Moore called Eckler from the Conway Medical Center.
And all he would say to me was he was sorry that he had made a wrong choice. And I said, what choice? You know, this doesn't make any sense. You know, why would you do this, you know, to us? I don't even understand this.
A few more days later, Moore called Eckler again and asked her to visit him at the hospital. He was still on suicide watch. While reluctant to see him, Eckler wanted answers, so she decided to go.
I'm like, you know, I'm just trying to understand this. You know, if you've had a breakdown, Adrian, we could have talked about this. We could have, you know, I just don't understand. You know, why won't you give me, you know, give me something? And he just said that that was the night that he told me that I wouldn't understand. That there wasn't anything, nothing he said was going to change my mind, because I'd already done told him the relationship was over. That I wasn't going to change my mind on anything. He just wanted to say goodbye to me in person.
Eight days later, and only 6 days before Christmas, on December 19th, 2012, Eckler's mother was helping her out with her babysitting business during the day. It was about 2:30 in the afternoon. Here's Eckler setting the scene for Detective Martin of the Horry County Police Department.
We've seen this car pull up.
Okay.
And I told the cops that it looked like, because my mom and I, you know, walked out onto the porch to see if it was
someone you knew.
Someone I knew, but to also to see if it was somebody that was coming to pick up one of the kids that we had.
Given that Memory Lane was a dead end road, the appearance of any unknown car was a strange occurrence.
Mom's like, "That's a weird car. I mean, it's very obvious who comes here every day."
Yeah.
You know, literally, it's the same cars every day.
It's
nothing
road.
It's indifferent. This is a dead-end road. We don't get much traffic in here unless it's going to your home or you're getting a visitor.
Yeah.
Eckler's mother went outside, and Eckler could hear her talking to someone. So Eckler decided to follow her outside and saw her talking to an African-American man with short dreadlocks. The man was looking for someone.
When he asked if Dre, and it sounded like he said Drake or Rake, and my mom was like, Rake, Drake, but my mom is hard of hearing.
Yeah.
So I'm like, and of course I said to him, I said, "Did you say Dre or Drake?"
Eckler figured that the man had the wrong address because she didn't know anyone who went by Dre or Drake, including her fiance.
So when this guy came up and asked for a Dre, I said,
"Did Adrian go by Dre?"
He never went by Dre with me. I didn't even know who.
No.
So I just simply said, "Well, there ain't no Dre that lives here."
Yeah.
And he said, while he was sorry, that he did say, he said, I'm sorry, I must have got the wrong house.
But while the man apologized, he took a long look at Eckler's Ford Expedition before driving away.
He had said, "Oh, I swore this, it looked like his car."
Which was your...
My Expedition.
Okay.
Eckler's mother assured the man that there wasn't a Dre or Drake who lived there, and the Expedition wasn't his vehicle. As the man drove away, Eckler noted the following about the man's car.
It looked like a white, gold, silver. It was like, it's a very old car. It wasn't white. It was like a silvery white car. It was very old. It was a four-door. It looked like there was a car seat in the back seat, but he wasn't able to get out of the driver's side door. He got in and out through the passenger side door.
Okay. Did you see like rust on it and stuff?
There was rust. It was an older car. It wasn't loud. I mean, it wasn't like that the car was ready to, you know, blow up.
And he was by himself?
And he was by himself.
And that was it. This was a strange experience for Eckler, but one she forgot about almost as soon as it was over.
You know, so I didn't think anything more about it that day.
Later that day, Eckler's good friend Jessica came over with a Christmas surprise.
Because then she knew I didn't have any money and bought me a real Christmas tree. Mm-hmm. And picked up, my oldest child was at a friend, so she didn't pick her up, but my youngest son, and my she brought in here with a tree to surprise me, mm-hmm. along with decorations.
At the end of the night, Eckler's son went home with Jessica, who had a stepson around his same age. Her 12-year-old daughter and she then started watching the movie Elf. As it got later, Eckler locked up the house, and her daughter and she went to the bedroom to continue watching the movie.
And I locked all the doors, mm-hmm. like I always do before bed. Come into our room, I said, we'll just finish watching Elf in Mommy's bed.
I hate to do this to you, but you think you can help me pick up the slack on those etch-a-sketches?
No problem.
In the movie Elf, Will Ferrell plays Buddy, an infant who crawls into Santa's toy sack and grows up in the North Pole thinking he's an elf before overhearing a conversation that serves as a rude awakening.
Buddy's killing me. Ernie got Lum Lum and Choo Choo pulling doubles.
Just quick thinking yesterday with that special talents thing.
I feel bad for the guy. Just hope he doesn't get wise.
Well, if he hasn't figured out he's a human by now, I don't think he ever will.
Soon after nodding off while watching Elf in the bedroom, Eckler had a rude awakening of her own.
Literally, we hadn't dozed off long, and I heard a chocolate, which isn't here because she's at my mom's mm-hmm. also, from the night of. Mm-hmm. I heard a knock, but I heard chocolate. It was almost like I was in and out. I heard the knock, but I heard chocolate, you know, kind of growling underneath her breath. But she is not a vicious, she's a chocolate yeah. lab, she's not a vicious dog.
Earlier in the day, Eckler's best friend Jenny had gone to the hospital to deliver her baby. Jenny's grandmother actually rented an apartment that was behind Eckler's house. And Eckler was so close to Jenny's grandmother that she actually referred to her as Grandma. Earlier in the night, at about 9:30, 10 o'clock p.m., Grandma told Eckler she was going to see Jenny in the hospital, and Eckler told her, no matter what, when you get back, come and let me know how they're doing.
The first thing that came to my mind was nothing about the person who was here prior to. I really thought it was Grandma coming, yeah. you know, wanting to let me know about Jenny.
Okay.
I turned the porch light on.
That porch?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And I come through and I turned the porch light on. And I opened the big door.
Okay. Did you have that leather lock set?
I always do.
Okay.
And so I opened it wasn't locked when I opened it. I mean, I literally unlocked the big door.
Okay.
But I always lock the glass door.
So you have that barrier.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Eckler didn't unlock or open the storm door, but she opened up the main door.
So I opened up the door, and there was a black girl.
How old
would
you say?
Very attractive. Probably in her mid-20s, maybe. She didn't look very old. She was very attractive. She, you know, had a good bit of makeup on. She had like the extensions in her hair to make it longer. Mm-hmm. She had boots on with some skinny jeans.
Last month, CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, wrapped up. CES is this incredible trade show. All the big tech companies unveil their newest innovations. It's like seeing the future in front of your very eyes. Our sponsor, Simply Safe Home Security, was there, and they had one of the most talked about products at this show, the new Simply Safe security camera. The camera connects to the sensors in your alarm system, so if an intruder tries to break in, the camera will automatically start recording. Then, not only will Simply Safe call the police, but you'll have actual evidence. So when the police arrive, you can say, here's the guy. It's truly incredible. Plus, with SimpliSafe, you can check in at home anytime, anywhere. Just live stream HD footage directly to your smartphone. If you want to see for yourself what SimpliSafe's brilliant technology can do for your home, go to SimpliSafeUndisclosed.com today. You'll even get a special 10% discount. That's SimpliSafeUndisclosed.com for 10% off your home security system. SimpliSafeUndisclosed.com. Earlier I mentioned Chaucer's tale of the Chanticleer and the Rooster. In this tale, the fox tricks Chanticleer out of his farmhouse, allowing the fox to abduct him. Chaucer makes the origin of this story clear, with Chanticleer being warned before the encounter that the fox is the new version of the Greek Sinon, who brought the Trojans sorrow by claiming that the Trojan horse was a gift that they should welcome into their gates. Ethel was given a similar warning.
She was very well put together, but that's when it hit me. You know, that's when the reality hit me, because she asked for Dre.
But while the woman asking for Dre made Eckler think that this and the incident earlier in the day might be connected to Adrian, she also figured that the woman's car might have broken down. While looking through the storm door, she could see that her car wasn't parked in the driveway, but instead was pulled off of the road and onto the grass.
I glanced over, because I could see a car, but it was dark. It was not in the driveway over here.
Okay.
It was this entrance. There's another entrance right over here on my in the front of the property
okay.
that is, goes into grass.
Okay.
But it was literally just pulled off the road, but inside on enough on the grass. But it was a dark, and I told the cop that, it was a dark car. It looked like a mid-sized car. I couldn't tell if it was new, if it was old, but it wasn't a white car where...
Like the same one from earlier in the day.
Yeah.
In addition to thinking that the woman might be having car trouble, Ethel was also having difficulty hearing what the woman was saying. At trial, Ethel would testify about her dog Chocolate, a 10-year-old big fat chocolate lab she'd had since Chocolate was 1.5. According to Eckler, Chocolate is a very well-behaved dog and had never been a dog to bark. This time was the exception.
Okay, she asked for Dre.
So she asked for Dre, but Chocolate was, at this time, Chocolate's barking, she's loud, foolish me.
You couldn't hear.
I couldn't hear.
Through the glass with the dog barking.
Yes.
So you opened.
And so I just, literally, as I turned, because it turns for it to slide the lock.
Right after Ector opened the door, something much like what happened with the Trojan horse transpired.
The girl literally went flying as soon as she went running off the porch this way.
When they came in. So she never came in. It was like she was the...
She was the guinea pig, as the man told me at the police station.
So, the woman was a decoy, designed to hide the men behind her who were laying in wait until Eckler opened the door.
So, I didn't... When that girl was standing there, I didn't see anybody around
okay,
her.
But they just kind of came out of nowhere, like...
Yes.
One of the men instantly pounced on Eckler.
But it was the instant... I didn't even know what they even had on, because it was instantly he had me in a chokehold.
Mm-hmm.
Which I have, there's so many bruises that I have, it's unbelievable.
While this bum rush made it difficult for Eckler to say much about the men, she was able to observe a few things.
The one that had the mask had the gun. And the only reason why I knew he had a gun is because he showed it, he was right in my face with it.
Okay. The one in the mask, they're both black males, obviously.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
But the one that had me at the chokehold had a jacket on.
Like what type of jacket?
It was, I couldn't tell what kind of jacket. It was heavy. It was thick.
Either wearing gloves, you think, or you didn't?
I didn't pay attention. Well, the one that had a gun did, because that was the friend who was right in my face.
What type of gloves?
It was
like
black, leather-looking gun, or guns. Leather-looking gloves. The gun, I told the police officer, it looked dull. It was black. It wasn't shiny. But it was definitely a smaller gun.
Mm-hmm. So the man who had her in a chokehold was wearing a jacket. The other man had on a mask and gloves that he was using to hold a dull gun that he was pointing at her. Ethel couldn't definitively say whether either of the assailants was the man who came to her house earlier in the day.
Anything in your mind make you think it was the guy from earlier in the day, or you don't know?
It never really...
Nothing popped in that you would say.
Not even his voice. No, there wasn't really, to be honest with you, I didn't even think about that guy.
it immediately became clear to Eckler why the men were at her house.
Where's the fucking money? Where is he at? Where's the fucking money? Over and over again. And I told, as I was on the floor, and I'm crying, and I'm telling him, there isn't no money. I'm telling him, there isn't no money. And that's when the reality is when I knew then that Dre was Adrian. There was no other doubt in my mind. I knew right away. Mm-hmm. And I kept telling him, my baby's in the back. Please just, he's not here. He's at Conway Medical Center. He hasn't been here in over a week. His shit is packed. He's not been here. You know, please just, my baby's in the back. I kept telling him over and over again.
The men, however, were undeterred. The one with the gun told Eckler to take them to the back room.
I said, please, my baby's back there. Mm-hmm. I promise you he's not here. So he drug me by the hair of my head in a chokehold through here. And in there. And in the meantime, Chocolate is trying to get through. She's pushing, trying to get through us, and he's demanding that I put the dog in my walk-in closet. Mm-hmm.
After Eckler put Chocolate in the closet, the men returned to their primary question.
He then had taken me in from the living room, from the bedroom to the bathroom, and threw me up against the sink, still asking me the same question. Mm-hmm. Where's the fucking money? Where's the fucking money? Where's he at? Where's the fucking money? Mm-hmm. And I kept saying the same thing.
From the bathroom, Eckler could only sit and listen to what was happening to her daughter, who had just had her 12th birthday a few days ago.
I hear him ask about the money.
Yeah.
And I'm, please just leave her alone. Please just leave her alone. I hear my daughter never shed a tear.
Yeah.
Never cried. Mm-hmm. I heard her say, we don't have any money. I only have $15. It's in my wallet, which was here on the table.
Mm-hmm. Eventually, the men stopped their interrogation.
He opens the bathroom door and he lets her in with me. Immediately, her and I are connected. Mm-hmm. We're sitting on my bathroom in front of the tub, and I pull out, because my cell phone was in. I had a bathrobe on, so I went to bed in that night.
Finally, the men left.
So we sat in there. I felt, I don't know how long. I mean, really, I really don't know how long. It felt forever.
Probably just a couple minutes.
Yeah. And we sat in there, and finally, we heard the car, because we were right here in the bathroom. We heard the vehicle leave.
With the men finally gone, Eckler and her daughter began looking through the house, and the purpose of the home invasion became even clearer.
She's like, he didn't even take my wallet. Mm-hmm. He didn't take anything.
She even told her there was $15 in there.
Yeah, he didn't take the wallet. He didn't take my pocketbook was sitting right over here. He didn't take my TV. He didn't take anything in this house.
Okay.
The only thing that they did was plunder through Adrian's things, which is obvious. They were looking for him. They made it very clear, you know, where is he and where's, you know, the money. They didn't take anything of anything in this house.
Anything you would say.
Yeah.
Having done this brief scan of the house, Eckler didn't want to stay there any longer.
So I grabbed Homer, I grab your phone, grab your charger, you know, baby, you know, we're going to have to leave here.
Yeah.
When Eckler and her daughter arrived at the police station, they were interviewed by Officer Rash. According to the police report, quote, both victims appeared very upset, sobbing, and shaky voices. The clips you've been hearing in this episode come from the interview of Eckler done by Detective Martin of the Horry County Police Department, who was assigned the case later in the day. The interview took place at Eckler's house. It would be the first and last time Eckler would return to the residence at Memory Lane.
I will not be moving back in this house. Mm-hmm. The three kids are petrified. I myself am petrified.
Her unease in being there is clear throughout the interview.
The back door just opened. Maybe the wind opened it. It wasn't shut all the way.
I didn't shut it that way.
Eckler's daughter wouldn't testify at Jamar Huggins' trial, but she did submit a victim impact statement that was read into evidence by the prosecutor toward the end of the sentencing hearing. It read as follows. That night, I was awoken by my mom getting up to answer the door. I thought she was going to turn off the air conditioning because it was cold. Then, all of a sudden, I heard my mom scream, and I saw a guy tackle her. And after that, I just pulled a blanket over my head and started whispering, "Oh my God, this isn't happening right now. Everything will be okay." Then I plugged my ears because I still heard them tell my mom to put chocolate my dog away. I could just hear by her voice that she was scared. Then they told her to get in the bathroom. They threw her in there. Then I came out of the covers and I saw a guy with a gun, Jamar Huggins. Then the other guy that was with him asked me, "Where's the money?" I replied, "We don't have any money. The only money we have is the $15 I have left for my birthday." He asked, "Where is it?" I said, "It's in my purse in the kitchen table." I was so scared. I was about to start crying, but then I thought to myself, "No, you've got to be strong for mommy." Then they told me to get up and go in the bathroom, and all I kept hearing was, "Stop, my baby is in there," from my mom's voice. Then when I was in the bathroom, my mom had her phone, and she was about to call 911, and I told her to just wait until they left. They were plundering through Adrian's stuff that my mom packed. After they left, I tried so hard not to cry because my mom was crying. I thought for sure Jamar was going in to shoot my mom. I'm so glad that he didn't. I love my mommy, and I was trying so hard to protect her. After they left, we came out of the bathroom, and we grabbed everything. I went into my purse to see if they really did take my money, but they took some of it. I and my mom got out of the house as quick as we could get, and my dog, and left the house and headed for the police station. I was shaking so bad that when I had to fill out the police report, my handwriting looked that way. I just wish that he'll get as most years as possible in jail for what he did to not only me and my mom, but for affecting my entire life. I also hope that he will give up the other guy who did this to us as well. I hope he learns a lesson from this. I hope he feels bad about what he did. I hope he gets as many years as possible. I have confidence that you will do just that. Taking a much-needed vacation can add years to your life, but planning it can take those years away. Seriously, with all the searching and researching, you may never make it to that first umbrella drink. So if you want to take the stress out of vacation planning, let me tell you about Tripping.com. There's no better place than Tripping.com to find your perfect vacation rental. Tripping.com gives you direct access to over 10 million properties, pulling from Vrbo, TripAdvisor, Booking.com, and dozens of other sites. Find the widest selection of vacation rentals around the world, all in one place. Tripping.com's comprehensive search allows you to easily compare prices, location, and amenities. And you can relax, knowing that you're getting the best price for your rental. You'll save an average of 18% per night when you use Tripping.com. Visit Tripping.com/undisclosed today to start and finish the search for your perfect vacation rental. That's Tripping.com/undisclosed. Tripping.com/undisclosed. Victim impact statements are a relatively recent development in American law. In 1976, the first victim impact statement was introduced in Fresno, California by Chief Probation Officer James Rowland. The first victim impact statement law passed 6 years later, also in the Golden State. In 1969, members of the Manson family cult killed Sharon Tate, an actress and the wife of director Roman Polanski. In 1982, one of her murderers, Charles Tex Watson, was up for parole. Fearing that Watson could be freed, Sharon's mother, Doris, successfully lobbied the legislature for a victim impact statement law, which allowed her to give testimony such as the following at Watson's parole hearing.
You cannot, or society cannot, and I'm not reading notes, they cannot trust you living next door to them. What mercy, sir, did you show my daughter when she was begging for her life? What mercy did you show my daughter when she says, "Give me 2 weeks to have my baby, and then you can kill me"? What mercy did you show her?
The same year as Watson's hearing, the President's Task Force on Victims of Crime recommended the admission of victim impact statements. 2 years later, South Carolina passed the Victims and Witnesses Bill of Rights, which included the right of victims to give victim impact statements at sentencing hearings. This was part of a nationwide trend known as the Victims' Rights Movement, intended to give a voice to crime victims who are so often forgotten in trials, largely focused on the accused. It was this trend that would lead the judge to be able to hear the words of Eckler's daughter explaining to him exactly the effect that the actions of Jamar Huggins had on the rest of her life. But despite the daughter naming Jamar Huggins as one of these perpetrators, she wasn't able to identify him as one of the assailants. Neither was her mother. So how did the Horry County Police get from Eckler's recounting of the home invasion to Jamar Huggins? next time on Undisclosed. I'd like to thank the following people: Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and host of the Crime Writers On podcast and These Are Their Stories podcast for audio production, Amanda Gaines for helping with audio production, Christy Williams and Nina Musser for website management, Baluki for our logo, Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for theme music, Mital Selhan, our executive producer. Some of the music you heard in this episode comes from Ward Dunn and his South Carolina band Pluto Wilson. You can find their music at plutowilson.bandcamp.com. The song playing over the credits is public domain music from South Carolina bluesman Pink Anderson, half the inspiration for the band name Pink Floyd. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Blue Apron, Simply Safe, and Tripping.com. And you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle UndisclosedPod. And you can tweet at us about this season by using the hashtag JusticeForJamar.
Why don't you walk, talk, squawk, mom, ain't nobody home with me. I'm looking at you all day long. It looks good to me. Well, the frog told the elephant, says, you need a grunt. You just mad because your tail in the front. Come on down to my house, huh? Ain't nobody home with me. Do you hear me? Ain't nobody home with me. Why don't you beat it up, miss?
And finally, in 2017, the University of South Carolina School of Law celebrates 150 years of contributing to the common good through a hands-on approach to legal education, leading to a cutting-edge understanding and application of the law. The School of Law will also move to its new state-of-the-art home this summer, built with the needs of today's students in mind. We've made National Jurist Magazine's Best Value Law School for 8 years in a row, and were named a top 50 go-to law school by the National Law Journal in 2016. If Undisclosed has inspired your interest to study the law, we encourage you to start your journey toward a legal career by visiting the University of South Carolina School of Law at law.sc.edu.
Why don't you come on here, ain't nobody home with me.